Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with dozens of students protesting the war in Gaza arrested today at Yale University following last week's arrest of over 100 at Columbia University, and speak with Alexander Salmon, a politics writer at Slate, who has previously written for Mother Jones, The New Republic, and The American Prospect. We'll discuss his latest article at Slate, What Just Happened at Columbia University, Inside the Student Protest That Led to More Than 100 Arrests. Then we'll look into the optics rather than the legal issues in today's opening arguments in the New York trial of Donald Trump, which has the former president off his pedestal, reduced to a criminal defendant, confronted with his sleazy behavior of sex with a porn star shortly after his wife gave birth to their son, and the cover-up of which an underling went to jail for. Joining us is Ann Nelson, a research fellow at Columbia University, author and lecturer in the fields of international affairs, media, and human rights, who was the director of the international program at Columbia's School of Journalism, where she created the first curriculum in human rights reporting. Her books include Red Orchestra, The Berlin Underground, and The Circle of Friends Who Resisted Hitler, and Shadow Network, Media Money and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right, now out in an updated paperback version. The new film Bad Faith, Christian Nationalism's War on Democracy, based on her book Shadow Network, starts streaming on multiple platforms on April the 26th. Then finally, we'll speak with Natalie Foster, the president and co-founder of the Economic Security Project and an Aspen Institute Fellow, a leading architect of the movement to build an inclusive and resilient economy. She speaks regularly on economic security, the future of work, and the new political economy. She previously founded the sharing economy community Peers, co-founded Rebuild the Dream with Van Jones, and served as digital director for President Obama's Organizing for America, a leading partner in winning transformative healthcare reform. We'll discuss her new book out tomorrow, Tuesday, The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Alexander Salmon, the politics writer at Slate, who has previously written for Mother Jones, The New Republic, and The American Prospect. And his latest article at Slate is What Just Happened at Columbia University, Inside the Student Protest That Led to More Than 100 Arrests. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Salmon.
Hey, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alex. And today there were dozens of protesters arrested at Yale University. And, of course, last week there were more than 100 arrests at Columbia. And today students at Columbia have been told to stay home. So you covered the protests at Columbia. Now we're hearing also that there may be more protests at Harvard. So what's driving these protests? Because they seem to be spreading, and it seems to be almost echoes of the Vietnam War days, even though back in the Vietnam War days, a lot of the students that were protesting could also be drafted. So what's happening in this new movement of campus protests?
Yeah, I think you're right. You're certainly right to draw on 1968 here, because it seems like the parallels are many. The interesting thing about Columbia in particular is that, you know, this is a campus where there's been a ton of activism on Israel and Palestine. There's been a widespread sort of popular objection to the Israel's war in Gaza, to any perceived support for that war. And so really for months, this has been sort of simmering on Columbia's campus. Columbia was one of the first universities to revoke the charter of both Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace, which are two prominent protest groups on campus. Students have been attacked on campus for their activism. In one instance, they were attacked with a chemical weapon called skunk, which resulted in numerous students going to the hospital seeking medical treatment. They've been doxxed by, by counter protesters and pro-Israel groups from outside. So this has been going on for months. The most recent thing that has returned this to the national news, of course, is that the university president in Columbia decided to call the NYPD to sweep a campus protest and arrest more than 100 students. That happened on Thursday afternoon. And so what we've seen now is sort of everything that's happening now is downstream of that decision, which I think is, largely unprecedented, very, sort of a stunning development in a lot of ways. And it sort of kicked off this rash of protests, both at Columbia and elsewhere at other university campuses.
And this is coinciding, of course, with the Columbia University president, Dr. Shafiq, testifying before the House Kangaroo Court, led by Elise Stefanik, who had already destroyed the career of the head of Penn and Harvard as well, having one resign and the other one forced out. I recall, though, at that hearing, the complete straw dog argument that Elise Stefanik was hammering away at these university presidents, saying that essentially, yes or no, answer me yes or no, do you tolerate calls for genocide of Jews on your campus? Well, guess what, Alex? There were no such calls of genocide for Jews on campuses. Have you ever heard of anybody calling for genocide of Jews on campus?
I certainly have not. In the time that I was at Columbia, the last handful of days, there was nothing even remotely in that neighborhood. I mean, this is what's so interesting about this issue is that, of course, like it's sometimes hard to believe that the two groups are even talking about the same thing, right? What campus protesters are actually saying, what they're actually calling for, is very specific, right? It's actually very there's a handful of very specific demands, and they're pretty fiercely on message. I mean, I was there for 2 days. I was there on Friday and Saturday, and to even get anyone to sort of wander even slightly off message was a challenge. I mean, even in my reporterly duties, trying to get someone to talk about anything beyond the demands that they have, that the protesters have for the campus, for the administration. Anything beyond that was very rarely spoken of. So the idea that there are widespread calls for genocide going on is just simply not true, right? And then it's very hard to have a productive conversation if that's your jumping off point. I think you're right to call it a kangaroo court. These House hearings have been absolutely preposterous, and the president of Columbia, I think you have to say, was slightly more prepared for what was going to happen there. I think that she was a little more adept in addressing some of those questions. But at the same time, the result ultimately looks pretty similar, right? Elise Stefanik is calling for her to resign anyways. There's basically no amount of throwing your student protesters under the bus that will satisfy House Republicans on this issue.
Well, I thought she was pandering and came across as a, spineless kind of academic bureaucrat, but that's just my opinion. But she did say, Dr. Shafiq, on Monday, she said that tensions on campus, and meaning Columbia, have been exploited and amplified by individuals who are not affiliated with Columbia and who have come to campus to pursue their own agendas. So are there outside forces stirring up these students, or are they doing it on their own?
Well, I think absolutely that's the case, or at least we can say that as the case as of today. But I don't think it's necessarily the people that we might think that she's alluding to there. I mean, some of those outside forces are, of course, congressional members of Congress, right? Like some of the top recipients of AIPAC money have made a pilgrimage to Columbia to make an issue out of this. Josh Gottheimer is on campus today. Kathy Manning. I mean, we're talking about representatives with Dan Goldman, top representatives of AIPAC money, who are there, to claim that Jewish students are not safe, that there are, these calls for mass violence or for genocide or for anything else. And so those are certainly outside agitators that are there for a political reason, for an ideological purpose. And so I would have to agree with that statement, overwhelmingly. the question of whether or not there are also, activist infiltrators. I think that some of the videos that have come in the last couple of days also make it seem like there are a small handful of people who have made, sort of, I think, inappropriate comments, maybe aggressive comments. But again, like, there seems to be no evidence that those people are the student protesters themselves. And so, again, like, you in a protest, you expect, that there are things happening on the margins. But again, does that seem representative of what's happening on campus? I mean, not to me. But in all the hours that I spent there, I didn't actually see any confrontations. I saw counter protesters. I saw, numerous student protesters, but I didn't see anything. I didn't see any dust ups really at all. And so, the rhetoric on this versus what's actually happening, it's really, really hard to reconcile them, which is why I felt like it was important for me to go to campus and report on it myself.
Well, even the White House has weighed in on this alleged anti-Semitism at Columbia, with the press secretary denouncing, quote, calls for violence and physical intimidation targeting Jewish students. Is that happening?
I saw that. It's interesting because it's hard to tell sort of where these are coming from. I think that there were a handful of confrontations between some counter protesters and maybe some other protesters who were sympathetic, some anti-Israel protesters from off campus. I saw videos of those on Instagram. It was really hard to tell who was who, and even really to make sense of what was being said. But I think that there is something of a game of telephone going on here, where Jake Tapper of CNN said relayed something. He was not there, but he said he had a conversation with a representative of a Jewish group in New York, who said it was wildly unsafe. And once that was presented as fact, then there are all these politicians downstream reacting to that. It's really very difficult to parse this stuff because there's just I don't think there's that much of it going on, and yet you have these reactions from the White House. From Eric Adams, the mayor of New York, made a very very strong statement as well about the sort of unthinkable anti-Semitic behavior that's going on in Columbia. But at the same time, the NYPD said something very different, right? Which is really interesting, that they said that there were, both when they swept the campus, that there was no credible threat there. They didn't identify any threat. And that even now, still, they're saying just today that they have identified no meaningful threat to either side in these actions. So you have a lot of politicians saying one thing, and in this very unusual circumstance, that even the NYPD, which tends to lean very conservative, which is obviously has a record a mile long on this stuff, is saying that actually there is no threat. And I think that's a really interesting divergence.
Well, the police chief of the NYPD, John Chell, said about these demonstrations, and where, by the way, Columbia's President Shafiq invited or requested the NYPD to come on campus. John Chell said that, quote, "The students that were arrested were peaceful, offered no resistance whatsoever, and were saying what they wanted to say in a peaceful manner." Now, one of course, the students that got arrested is Representative Ilhan Omar's daughter, who's now homeless, right? Because she got kicked out of student housing.
That's right. Yeah. So the consequence for those students who were arrested on the disciplinary side was much worse than the consequence on the legal side. So right, because of course, as you can see in the police chief's own testimony, that they're those kids went willingly. There was little resisting. There was it was a very straightforward arrest, and most of the kids there were given a citation. I think the worst of it came from Barnard and Columbia, the choice to suspend those students, which means that any student who's in student housing, which obviously in New York City, a lot of these students are in student housing because the cost of housing is so expensive. A lot of the students rely on the university for their health care, for food, obviously the dining halls, all that. With the suspension, access to all that is revoked, and the university did that immediately. So Ilhan Omar's daughter and 100 other students now are without access to all of that stuff. And for a number of students, that's a really, critical lifeline, right? Your housing, your medical care, and your food are not trifling concerns. So, the consequences have been pretty significant. But again, the legal consequences haven't been, because as the story that we're hearing from the NYPD is very different than the one that we're hearing from politically motivated actors, including the university's own president.
So what's happening then with the broader issue about sympathy for Israel versus sympathy for the Palestinians, and to some extent, the decades-long agony between Israel and Palestine? It's been a kind of competition of victimhood. But now the tables have turned. Even though Hamas did the most brutal and disgusting attack on Israeli civilians, the response from Netanyahu and Israel is such that now Israel is losing its credibility and support around the world. And presumably that is a big part of how these students on campus at both Columbia and Yale and Harvard, et cetera, and around the country in general. And we know that the White House is worried about losing the student vote or the young vote. So what are the students telling you of why they're doing this? Why are they supporting the Palestinians in this situation?
It's fascinating, because there are two very specific asks, I think, and the one which was repeated to me constantly was this sort of three-pronged request at Columbia specifically, is for divestment of university holdings in corporations that benefit from the Israeli occupation of the occupied territories in Palestine and the war in Gaza. Two is financial transparency, total financial transparency about where the university is invested, so that there's a clear review of how those finances and how those holdings are being used in the service of the Israeli state or the Israeli government. And the third thing was amnesty for the students who've been arrested or suspended. So amnesty for the organizers, a reinstatement of those suspended to the universities and to their housing and everything else. The broader picture there, which is also something that was, there was a lot of discipline on this message. I was honestly surprised by how much there was just that the ongoing support for this campaign in Gaza is just unacceptable to these students. And we've seen that, on polling nationwide, right, that young Americans in particular are overwhelmingly opposed to what they see as, a genocide in Gaza, the mounting famine there. I mean, these are not concerns that they take lightly. And it's not really equivocal for this demographic. They're very, very strongly opposed to what they see is just a campaign of mass slaughter with now 40,000 Palestinians dead. And we're seeing this on college campuses everywhere, and it's a huge issue for the White House, which has continued to support Israel in spite of all of this. I mean, the mounting evidence about what's going on in the region is has led obviously the UN to start taking pretty significant measures, but the U.S. has not, and Biden has been unwilling, and so I think that is a big part of this. This is something that young voters and young Americans, college students, care greatly about. They think it's an incredible injustice, and the American support for that has become basically unconscionable in their estimation.
So just in closing, though, obviously the pro-Israel right is basically saying that these students are dupes of Hamas, and that's the charge. If you don't support Israel, you're supporting Hamas. And obviously Hamas is a terrible organization. So what are students' response to that charge, that they're either dupes of Hamas or they support Hamas?
Yeah, it is interesting, right? You hear that a lot coming from the Israel lobby and the pro-Israel side of things. I don't think that they're, if there was so much support for Hamas, it would be it would be stated. I think the overwhelming sentiment of the chants that I heard while I was there, of the signs and the posters and everything else, was that you have what's an incredible humanitarian crisis on your hands in Palestine now, and that the number of women and children who've been killed and who are starving to death is the primary concern, and that the continued transfer of weapons, despite these, gross violations of human rights, that is the primary consideration at this moment. It's a concern that these students want to see that effort stalled. They want to see a ceasefire, and I think that anything beyond that sort of seems downstream. I really did not get the sense that there's a lot of Hamas sympathy here, but I think that there is a lot of concern for a military campaign that has, really, I think, gone off the rails according to, the international community, Americans widely, and I think that there's just very, very little support for what we've been seeing happening there for months now, and that I think is the primary concern.
Well, Alexander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Salmon, who is a politics writer for Slate, who has previously written for Mother Jones, The New Republic, and The American Prospect. And his latest article at Slate is What Just Happened at Columbia, Inside the Student Protests That Led to More Than 100 Arrests. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the optics rather than the legal issues in today's opening arguments in the New York trial of Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ann Nelson, an author and lecturer in the fields of international affairs, media, and human rights, who was the director of the international program at the Columbia School of Journalism, where she created the first curriculum in human rights reporting. Her books include Red Orchestra, The Berlin Underground, and The Circle of Friends Who Resisted Hitler, and Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right, now out in an updated paperback version. And she is a research scholar at Columbia University. And the new film, Bad Faith, Christian Nationalism's War on Democracy, based on her book, Shadow Network, starts streaming on multiple platforms on April the 26th. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ann Nelson.
Thank you, Ian.
So, Ann, what's going on at the camp? I obviously want to talk to you about the first day of the Trump trial in New York with opening arguments from both the prosecution and the defense. But what's going on at Columbia and today at Yale and tomorrow perhaps at Harvard?
Right. Well, I can't speak for all of them, and I'd like to just stick with my immediate personal observations because they've been going on for a few days. And actually, they've been going on for a lot longer than that. We just haven't had the media attention focused on them. They've been going on for several months. I'm a research fellow at Columbia, so I do have access to the campus. And I was there on Friday and was able to watch what was happening and speak with a few people about what was going on. Now, what I think the media is not adequately appreciating is that there are actually two protests happening. So right now, people like myself and students, active students, have ID cards, and there is campus security, has been for a few days, who are only admitting people with active Columbia IDs to the main campus. So if you go into the main campus on 116th Street, at least on Friday when I was there, there were what I would say would be several hundred students. There were some tents. They had been cleared a day or two before, and then they were readmitted. And the students or the protesters, all of whom had Columbia IDs, supposedly, were sitting quietly. Some of them were talking quietly. And in front of the library, there was a young woman who was singing a mournful song that sounded from a distance like it was in Arabic. So it was very calm. Now, step outside the campus, and it was a totally different story. You had another several hundred protesters who supposedly didn't have Columbia IDs and were from outside organizations, outside communities, who were much more virulent and were chanting things like Intifada and revolution. And of course, New York has a very lively political culture and many different viewpoints. That protest, which was absolutely different in terms of tone and presentation, had what I saw to be maybe a dozen New York City policemen in attendance. It, when I was there, it was not violent, but it was much more, it was at a much higher pitch. It was like night and day from what was going on inside Columbia. So I am seeing news stories that are depicting the protest outside Columbia as the Columbia protest and blaming the Columbia administration for it. And all I can say is the Columbia administration has no legal right to bar people from standing on the sidewalk on Broadway and shouting what they want to shout. So we've known from the start that there have been outside interests who have been trying to promote a less civil form of protest on the campuses, certainly Columbia, but not just Columbia, and administrators who are trying to defend freedom of speech, but struggling to maintain a balance.
So, Anne, thanks for that update. And let's talk about the first day of the trial of Donald Trump in New York, where opening arguments came from both the prosecution and the defense. And rather than get into the legalisms, I'm just trying to pull back and gauge what perhaps is happening out there in the broader zeitgeist in terms of what the optics are. And the bottom line seems to me is that the defendant, Donald Trump, is just a complete sleazebag. He always has been. He hung out with Jeffrey Epstein. They were very close friends until they had a falling out over a real estate deal in Florida. When he first started out in real estate, he hung out with the mob. He was schooled by the mob lawyer, Roy Cohn. He's always had fascination. He tries to sort of act like a mob boss, a tough guy. That's why he loves Putin, because Putin's the ultimate tough guy. I mean, there's nothing much about this guy that you can say that's anything but one of the most dreadful human beings on the planet. He's just a wretched man. And it feels to me like what's happening now, even though there's a lot of people invested in this finally bringing him to justice, and it may not do that, but it feels a little bit like the end of the Wizard of Oz, where you pull back the curtain and the great and all-powerful Oz is this pathetic little man. Now,
well,
go ahead.
Pardon?
<That's>, yeah. Now that I've had my speech, how did it strike you? Yeah, exactly. Now you've heard from what I think.
So I've lived in New York City for many years, and for us, and I would say, you know, the people, many, many people in my world, it was astonishing that he was taken seriously as a political figure in the first place, because he was almost a figure of ridicule in New York. I mean, he was a figure of ridicule. Let's face it. Spy magazine famously covered him as the short-fingered Bulgarian. That was the epithet they attached to him. And the stories that you'd read about him in New York was about how the contractors would report that he stiffed them and would commission construction work and then never pay for it. And then, of course, there was the string of women who had complaints of really outrageous sexual abuse. And he always managed to deploy these delaying tactics and these legal maneuvers and elude accountability. But it was just a common sentiment that this was not a person that you would respect. Now, when you take him to the national stage through The Apprentice and his reality TV career, he took on a new life. And really, those shows were what propelled him to the presidential nomination. He wasn't going to win the presidency without the support of various right-wing and religious right organizations, which, of course, I describe in my book, Shadow Network. So they got behind him and pushed. They figured out how to sell voters in swing states on him, and pastors and people in their network. So he's been propelled to power through these coalitions, and he's been the front man. He's been the circus master. Now, if he is indeed debilitated by the lawsuits and by the various obstacles he's facing, these organizations will still look for ways to win the election, whether through state legislature maneuvers, like the state legislature doctrine, through legal maneuvers, through the courts. They need him, but it's not clear at the moment whether he's absolutely essential to all of their strategies.
So when you, what do you see, though, in terms of, I mean, there are these reports of him nodding off, and he seems, at the very least, irritated, perhaps even wounded. And this is just, this trial is just starting, and he's tried all these histrionics and to push the envelope in terms of the gag order. But this could go on for a while. And what's your impression of where this may lead? And again, we're not talking about the legal aspect of it, but the sort of the optics.
In terms of the optics, he's very much out of his element. He's a fish out of water, gasping for breath. So what we see, you know, he's somebody who's used to being in control. And he's achieved that through throwing money around, through bullying people, through firing people. And all of a sudden, he's removed from his stage, quite literally, and put in this environment where he has the least control. He is subject to the judgment of others. He's also subject to the judge's control of his behavior. And this is utterly unaccustomed for him. But you also see him diminished because he isn't able to feed off the energy of his crowd, right? There's a form of adrenaline that kicks in, and that's when he turns on his own weird form of charisma. And at the moment, he seems beleaguered and maybe even depressed, and perhaps contemplating the idea that his old formula may not work. Now, it's hard, you know, if he's going to try to draw on his old tactics of, you know, yelling at the judge, that's not going to work for him now.
Right. Well, since you've written about Hitler, and I know that comparisons with Trump are somewhat overwrought, but nevertheless, there are some real aspects of this wannabe strongman, this fascination with dictators he has, and also the wannabe mob boss fascination that Trump appears to model himself on. And, of course, these characters, like Hitler, were surrounded with sleaze, Goebbels being such a deviant, along with the drug addict Goering and the sociopath Himmler and so forth, and Eric Rome and all of that. So is there a kind of pathology here in terms of neo-fascists, wannabe mob bosses, people that are fascinated, live in that milieu, model themselves on these kind of people in terms of sleaze? Because, you know, you judge them essentially by their roles in history, having killed hundreds of millions of people. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, as Bertolt Brecht tried to write, do in his play, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Wey, these are really horrible, sleazy people.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I think that there are some, you know, as they say, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And one thing that you have in common is the quasi criminal element that you had with the brown shirts and the stormtroopers of Hitler, who included a lot of low grade criminals. In fact, you know, even with the Nazi marching song, the Horst Wessel song. Horst Wessel was actually a pimp who belonged to the Nazi party, and, you know, got into a scuffle and was killed, and he was lionized by the party. But I think you have to go beyond that and look to the big business interests, the corporate interests in Germany, like the Krupp's arms manufacturers and the IG Farben chemical industries, who got behind Hitler because they thought they could control him and they thought that he would be good for corporate profits. And in the short term, he was. You've got a lot of major mega donors from American business interests who've gotten behind Trump and put money into not just his campaign, but supporting organizations such as the ones I've written about, because it's in their financial interest. So what's really, really hard in both cases is having representational democracy organize itself quickly enough and sufficiently to counter these powerful forces. It's not impossible, but it takes a great deal of common effort.
Well, Ann Nelson, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ann Nelson, who's an author and lecturer in the fields of international affairs, media, and human rights, who was the director of the international program at the Columbia School of Journalism, where she created the first curriculum in human rights reporting. Her books include Red Orchestra, The Berlin Underground, and The Circle of Friends Who Resisted Hitler, and Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right, now out in an updated paperback version. And she's also a research fellow at Columbia University. And the new film, Bad Faith, Christian Nationalism's War on Democracy, based on her book, Shadow Network, starts streaming on multiple platforms on April the 26th. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of a new book out tomorrow, Tuesday, The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's New Economy.
Well, I'm sitting behind my desk in Washington, D.C., and everyone on cable news is yelling at me. And there's only one place in this whole wide world I wanna go. That's down underneath the Florida sun in Mar-a-Lago.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Natalie Foster, the president and co-founder of the Economic Security Project and an Aspen Institute Fellow, a leading architect of the movement to build an inclusive and resilient economy. She speaks regularly on economic security, the future of work, and the new political economy. She previously founded the Sharing Economy Community Peers, co-founded Rebuild the Dream with Van Jones, and served as a digital director for President Obama's Organizing for America, a leading partner in winning transformative healthcare reform. Her new book, out on Tuesday, is The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Natalie Foster.
Thank you. It's so great to be here with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the next economy, I mean, the current economy, by all accounts, is doing well with all the usual metrics. But ironically, not everybody in America thinks they're doing well. So let's start with the current economy before we talk about the next economy. Why is there this disconnect, do you think, Natalie?
You're right that the current economy, by all the metrics we typically use, is doing well. The market is up, you know, GDP is up, it's humming right along. And yet, 25% of one in four Americans can't pull together $400 if needed to in an emergency, that people are extremely in debt, they're stressed, student debt has hit trillions of dollars. This country has become a country of precarious financial situations for so many families. And it's no wonder then that people feel the precarity of the economic situation, despite the fact the market is doing well. There's a real disconnect. And that's why I think something like the guarantee economy is important.
But the two fundamentals, or at least amongst the main fundamentals in terms of what we spend our money on and what we need, are groceries and gasoline. And we have no control over these prices. They seem to be going through the roof. And of course, Vladimir Putin and Mohammed bin Salman hold Biden's fate in their hands because they can jack up the price of gas just before the elections and we'll end up with Trump.
Yeah, there are many possibilities, many scenarios for an October or November surprise this year. But you're right that the price of gas, the price of groceries, that is what is on people's minds. The other thing on people's minds is the extraordinary debt that they hold. You know, we've over the past several decades of economic policymaking have decided that things that were once public goods, like college, now are personal investments that one has to make on their own and take out massive debt in order to get. And so we live with the ball and chain of debt in this country, when in fact it should be something that we understand as, you know, a public good and be guaranteed for all.
So in talking about your new economy, I can't help thinking there's a sort of back to the future aspect here, Natalie, in the sense that if you go back to 1944 with FDR, President Roosevelt's, what is called the Second Bill of Rights that he enunciated. And let me just quickly read them, because they still resonate through the ages. Mm-hmm. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, and the right to a good education. So what happened?
I really appreciate you reading those, Ian. It's like, gives me goosebumps to hear the words written, you know, at that era of American history. What would happen would be the rise of, call it trickle-down economics, call it Reaganomics, call it neoliberalism. In 1947, a group got together called the Mont Pelerin Society, and they really didn't appreciate the vision that was being laid out at the time, the role government was playing. They wanted more freedom, what they understood to be freedom, you know, in their lives. And so they'd write the Statement of Aims, and they would start to build it into the academy, into journalism, into all the, you know, gatekeeping institutions of our time. And when the chaos of the 60s and 70s would hit, spiraling inflation, wars, much like now, they would move, you know, Ronald Reagan would be elected here in this country, Margaret Thatcher in the UK. And these ideals, summed up by three core tenets: total faith in the market, zero faith in government, and people left pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. That orthodoxy would become the reigning orthodoxy of the land. And that's what we have lived under for the last 45 years on both sides of the aisle. 2008, that orthodoxy was proven to have no close, right? The government would, you know, shore up the banks in a great economic and housing crisis, but would leave Americans out to dry. 10 million Americans lost their homes. Of Black and Latino families lost half their collective wealth during that period of time. And I believe then we entered a period where it was a transition. What would come next? You would see Occupy Wall Street. You would see in 2016, two candidates that looked unlike any candidates before them, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And what would happen is Joe Biden would become president in 2020. The pandemic would hit, and we would see something extraordinary, something that reached back to the New Deal, that would say government has a role in ensuring markets work, that they're competitive, that we can afford basic things, and we're going to support people in the greatest of crises. And so that's my sort of backdrop to the book and saying, you know, this is what's happened. And it's why we're in this historic moment of transition to a new economy. Now, we have a choice. One could become much more authoritarian and austere, or it could be building on the guarantees that we've begun to see over the past few years.
So is this a vision of a social democracy in this country, which arguably we had a version of social democracy from 1944 to about 1977?
Sure. I think one could think of it that way. I prefer to think of it as an evolution of capitalism. one that venture capitalist Roy Bahat calls trampoline capitalism, where, you know, guarantees are abundant in our society for business, right? There's the guarantee of patents and the guarantee of the courts, and the guarantee that shareholders won't be held liable for, you know, any corporate mismanagement. There's all kinds of guarantees. So why not extend them to the people who make the economy run, to the everyday people who work, who buy, who purchase, who live lives in this economy? So I think of it as the next evolution of capitalism.
But in terms of alienation, which is clearly affecting our politics and has led to Trump's rise, alienation combined with conspiracy theories, ill education, et cetera, you get the feeling that so many Americans on the left and the right feel they don't feel they have a stake in this country anymore. And frankly, in terms of revenues that keep the government going, the billionaire class clearly don't have a stake in it because they get all the benefits and the rewards, but they don't pony up. So it seems to me, how do you get a new social contract here, you know, without basically attacking the plutocracy?
That's a great question. The new social contract is exactly what's needed. And it's needed because of the precarity the last 50 years have left us with. But it's also needed as we march squarely into the age of AI and the disruptions that will inevitably come to the workforce. As some jobs are eliminated, more jobs are created. Historically, when new jobs are created, they aren't always good jobs, right? They're often in the informal economy without benefits and protections. And so in those labor disruptions, workers who earn the least are the most affected. So it's, I think, more incumbent than ever to create a new social contract and a floor through which no one can fall. Your point about having a stake in this economy is absolutely right. You know, I believe right now, after the last 50 years of neoliberalism, we are in a downward spiral when it comes to our democracy. People are stressed. They're working three jobs, and they've been gaslit with this story that it's their fault. That if you can't make it in today's economy, it's your own fault. You should have pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. When in fact, there are so many reasons why people aren't able to make it. The game is rigged and it's stacked against them. And so when people experience that, they feel shame. And when people feel shame, they can't trust. They lash out. They judge in different ways, projecting, you know, the shame on to others. And that is the downward spiral we're in. When we feel shame, we can't trust. And when we can't trust, we can't be part of institutions. I believe a world with an economic floor would start to build the upward spiral where people are more involved. There's more time and presence available to them to be engaged in community, to have more of a stake in community. And you could see how it would start to result in more share of the economic pie and spiral up from there when, you know, people are more involved in politics. So I believe you're right about the current moment, but that there's something else possible.
So I'd love to hear more about the utopian vision of a guarantee, because the dystopian vision of a guarantee is a universal income, which the Silicon Valley titans want. But they also, Zuckerberg wants everybody to have his helmet on, living in a world of virtual reality and sitting around on the couch eating corporate food and getting a guaranteed income. And it's just, I don't know whether it sort of reminds me of that movie, The Idiocracy. And to some extent, I'm wondering whether we have become an idiocracy.
Well, the exciting thing about the idea of a guarantee economy is that it's no longer utopian or pie in the sky. So let me just paint a picture over the last few years. We as a nation mobilized the National Guard to put free vaccines in people's arms. We mailed out tests for the vaccine via the Postal Service for free to every family in America. And when millions of people were thrown out of work overnight, losing both their income and their health coverage, Medicaid would catch them, resulting in the lowest uninsured rates in American history. All of that is a healthcare guarantee. On the housing front, government would purchase hotels and move the unhoused in, giving people a room of their own with a key of their own. We would pass an eviction moratorium that was a first of its kind. We would give people subsidies, like support to be able to stay in their homes to both afford the rent or the mortgage. All of that, and we'd build more housing units across this country. All of that is a housing guarantee. And, you know, we would say, as a nation, government would say, nobody pays on their student loan debt for years, freeing these student debtors who walk around with the ball and chain up each month to use that money on things that are important to them. We would then outright cancel billions of dollars of student debt. That is a college guarantee. We would also expand the child tax credit and send every parent in this country a check, you know, or a debit directly into their account with no strings attached to help with the rising cost of living and raising their children. That is an income guarantee. So it is no longer pie in the sky. It's here. We've built the floor. Now, some of those things have expired. Some of those things, you know, had significant challenges in their execution, but we're just at the beginning. And I think what's important is that these things have now happened in the United States of America. You know, forever, I was told that wasn't possible. I grew up in Kansas. I was a high school debater. So I would read, you know, the U.S. News and World Reports. And it was like the economy was like the weather, right? It was something that happened to us. And I just sort of assumed this is how it had to be, you know, total faith in the market, zero faith in government, people left pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, like put up a bigger umbrella. But in fact, it's not true that we've seen a significant shift that the pandemic moment offered us despite all of the great loss and suffering. And so it's my belief we need to build on this.
Well, going back to 1944 and FDR's second Bill of Rights, which I read earlier in this conversation, Natalie, are we at a point now where this is a struggle between freedom, because of all the freedoms from want that FDR enunciated, but on the other hand, the critics and the people who are hysterical about what happened with the very responses to COVID that you just enumerated, they all treat it now on the right and amongst people like RFK Jr. On the libertarian side, they all say that this is an infringement on our liberty. So you have liberty versus freedom. And liberty has reached the point in this country where it's threatening life and the pursuit of happiness.
I think that is well said. You know, this is a contest for our understanding and the future of freedom and liberty. Does it mean, you know, the ability to live in a world without chronic stress, to show up for your family in the way you want to be present, to have agency over your lives? You know, I think of a participant in a guaranteed income study. By the way, I'd love to circle back with you on guaranteed income because I have a different view of it. And in Stockton, California, where the first mayor-led pilot of guaranteed income happened, there was a recipient named Tomas. And Tomas had worked three jobs to make ends meet, to put food on the table for his family. And when those $500 a month checks started coming in the door, he was able, you know, the first one he wasn't sure about. The second one, he thought, all right, this is really happening. The third one, he thought, okay, I can actually quit my third gig and spend a little more time with my family. And so he did. One Saturday morning, he took his kids to the pool. He sat on the side of the pool watching them swim and realized he didn't know that they had known how to swim. They learned without him because he had never been able to spend a leisurely Saturday morning with his kids. That is freedom. That is liberty.
Well, one of the things that happened during the COVID pandemic, which seemed so hopeful, but now we're back to our worst habits, was the fact that people didn't have to spend hours here, particularly in Los Angeles, sitting on freeways for hours every day, belching pollution into the air as they crawl along. And this, we're back to it now. The alternative was then you don't have to go into the office. You can telecommute. You can work on your computer and on your home PC, get your work done, spend more time with your family. It's almost like it was an accidental eye-opener to the very alternatives that you're talking about. But yet we went back to the worst of habits, and now we're making these pointless commutes, belching pollution into the air, and living in gridlock.
It is true that it was extraordinary, the shifts in society that we saw. And, you know, much has been written recently about how this nation perhaps suffers from an emotional long COVID, from the inability to really process what happened, you know, during that period of time. But if we'd had this conversation 5 years ago, it would have been unimaginable that there would be so much working from home, right? That Zoom culture would be so strong, and all of that would shift overnight. And it's not entirely back to normal. There, you know, it is all being litigated right now as people move to hybrid proposals. You know, you work from home Monday and Friday, and Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you're in the office, or people are shifting jobs based on whether or not they have to be back in the office. And then there's younger workers saying being back in the office is really important for us. We have no other way of networking and understanding this landscape if we aren't with, you know, older workers. So I think that there is absolutely a lot that's shifting, but something profound did happen. You know, Arundhati Roy wrote about the pandemic as a portal, asking the question, you know, will we come through the portal new and clean and fresh, or will we drag all of our baggage with us? And, you know, it's my belief that it's somewhere in the middle, but it's also my belief that these things aren't determined, that it is actually a contest for the future right now. And it's up to us to push for the world we want.
Well, Natalie Foster, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's great to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Natalie Foster, who's the president and co-founder of the Economic Security Project and an Aspen Institute Fellow, a leading architect of the movement to build an inclusive and resilient economy. She speaks regularly on economic security, the future of work, and the new political economy. She previously founded the Sharing Economy Community Peers, co-founded Rebuild the Dream with Van Jones, and served as a digital director for President Obama's Organizing for America, a leading partner in winning transformative healthcare reform. Her new book, out on Tuesday, is The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by